Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Yaakov Katz and joined as always by Lahav Harkov. And Lahav, last week we recorded our podcast from the Jerusalem Post conference that we had. I think it was a great episode. It was a great conference. And one thing that you and I guess did not pick up on at the time, maybe because to us it was not such a big deal, but to others it apparently was the session that was with Ayelet Shaked. So let's just give a little background. Ayelet Shaked, the interior minister, member of the government from the Yamina party, appeared at our conference, was interviewed on stage by our colleagues, Gil Hoffman, the political correspondent at our paper, The Post, as well as by Tal Shalev, who holds the same role at the website Walla, which is also part of the Jerusalem Post group. Anyhow, during her conversation, Ayelet Shaked, who I think has always spoken a fine English, right? Obviously not perfect. She's born and bred in Israel. She was never educated in the United States. She never spent time living outside of Israel. But her English is at a very decent level. Yes, with an accent, was going through the interview, answering questions. And at one point was answering a question about politics and how the public views her party's success. And what they've achieved in this government. And she got stuck on a word. The word in Hebrew was leha'arich, to appreciate. She was talking about the appreciation of politicians. And she turned to Tal, one of the people interviewing her, and asked her, how do you say leha'arich? Tal answered, and that was it. And the show continued. But later, former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's spokesperson, Topaz Luke, who I think you know quite well, started tweeting out that section, and everyone just it became a downpour of criticism, a full on assault against Ayelet Shaked for the way she spoke English.
There was a whole news segment on Khan about politicians who don't speak English well and why do they even bother trying? Why don't they speak Hebrew and have translation? They compared her to Amir Peretz and David Levy, who are known for their incredibly poor English, like so much so that there are jokes about them that, you know, what is it? We're 25 years after David Levy and I still know David Levy jokes.
Right.
and I just think like it's not, you can't. Can't even compare. Not that like I don't even know what Debbie Levy's English really is like because I was a child. But Amir Peretz does not speak English. Like the example, and they showed a clip in this news thing is, you know, he's basically reading from a piece of paper and doesn't know what he's saying. And Ayelet Shaked, you can have a very good conversation with her in English. I in fact have. Usually I speak to her in Hebrew, but I have interviewed her in things that have been recorded. I think past Jerusalem Post conferences, I've interviewed her on stage. And she's perfectly fine. And it's like this, you know, like, I don't, it's Topaz Luke's job, right? To do sort of opposition research. But I think that the level of like scandal that this has become is ridiculous because she's not the only person with an accent or with a very strong accent. She's not the only person who stumbles on a word sometimes. And in either direction, right? Like she's not an English speaker, but her English is pretty good. And there are many people in this country for whom Hebrew is not their native language, and they might take a second and to remember a word in Hebrew instead of Russian or Arabic or whatever other language. And it's just, it's so strange almost in our country where you have so many immigrants from so many different countries and so many different accents to pretend that an accent or forgetting one or two words in a 10-minute interview should be a barrier to anything.
Well, if I could just add to that, listen, I've been living in Israel now for 28 years, okay? I still have an American accent when I speak Hebrew. I can't get that resh down. What am I going to do about it? Nothing. That's the way I speak Hebrew. My Hebrew, I think, is very good. But at the same time, do I make mistakes? Of course I do. Do I have perfect grammar? No. Do I sometimes miss a word? Yeah. And I will say it in English. But is that going to prevent me from appearing in public? Is that going to prevent me from interviewing people, from going on the radio, which I've done in the past, going on Hebrew television, which I've done in the past? No. Right. And I think that, like you mentioned, in this country, which really is a kibbutz galuyot, right, an ingathering of the exiles of Jews from all around the world. We have people here who have Moroccan accents because they came from Morocco. We have over a million Israelis who live in this country who came from the former Soviet Union, right? They speak with an accent. Hundreds of thousands of people who came from the United States and France and other places and you know, South America. So this whole idea.
20% of the country is Arabs. They come from here, but they have a different accent.
Right. I think Lahav, it strikes at something deeper, if I could just say. And I think it has to do with a certain segment of the society that is not part of that immigrant population that just has difficulty in accepting the fact that there are people who sound a little different. You know, to you and I, and we were speaking about this earlier, we didn't think much of Ayelet Shaked's, I wouldn't even call it a stumble, but her question to Tal to help her translate a word. That's something that's part of the norm, and I don't think that should be a barrier for people to speak either in Hebrew or in English.
Yeah, and I also think just, you know, to talk about what you were saying about the sort of almost snobbiness of this, it's also weird that it's coming from Likud, right? Because they sort of campaign on defending the downtrodden, so to speak. You know, that they, one Israeli commentator, Avishai Ben Chaim, calls the second Israel, the sort of second class Israel, I guess you would say. You know, so they expect everybody to speak perfectly and have perfect accents and to, you know, be multilingual and without any mistakes. It just, it's somewhat inconsistent. And it's just, you know, they just want to mock a political opponent. Like in the end, it's like so many people have fallen for basically a cheap political tweet.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, and maybe this ties into the next topic that I thought we could discuss, which is the Rabin Memorial, where everything just becomes political in this country.
I mean, with Rabin, I don't think becomes is the right word. I actually think it's been like this for a very long time. But go ahead.
Well, you're probably right, is that it's always been political. But, you know, my point more is that there are certain things that are supposed to be above politics, right? And, you know, so Thursday, maybe I'll tie it to something else. Thursday night, there was a ceremony for the incoming head of Shabak, of the Shin Bet. And the former prime minister, Netanyahu, was there, and the current prime minister, Bennett, was there. Bennett apparently spoke first and said something about how we've changed you know, there's no longer a culture of I, it's a culture of we, basically sticking it to Bibi. And Bibi gets up and in his opening remarks, where you usually recognize all the different dignitaries or officials who are there, completely skipped over the fact that there's a prime minister sitting in the audience, right? And some people apparently yelled out, you know, there's a prime minister here. And then we have the Rabin Memorial, which Netanyahu, during his 12 consecutive years as prime minister, traditionally attended, and now as opposition leader, did not attend. So I would have hoped, Lahav, that there's some things that are above politics.
Well, but not only Netanyahu didn't attend, and the reason that sources in Likud told Gil Hoffman was that they didn't want, you know, that Netanyahu was sick of having to sit there while people sort of deride him and blame him for incitement and things like that. And to me, like, from experience, that's true. That's what happens at the Rabin Memorial. And then it actually happened this time. Rabin's grandson was like, you know, we've now gone from like the rule of one person to a real democracy or something like that, you know, in the shift of, you know, from Netanyahu's government to the new government. And, you know, far be it from me to tell a family how to grieve their loved one. But if they're in an official state ceremony, like, I think that that's inappropriate. And it has happened many times in the previous years, which is why I don't necessarily think Netanyahu did the right thing. But when they said that was the reason, I was like, well, yeah, I mean, he does get attacked every time, practically.
No, but by the way, I get it. And with all my criticism of Netanyahu, I also, you know, he's no longer the prime minister. When he was the prime minister, he had to be there, right? You can't skip that.
And he was there.
And he was there. Yeah. Every year he was there, and he would sit there and they would trash on him. And, you know, whether it's legitimate or not is a separate question that's more for historians, of how much of a role he played in the culture or environment of incitement that existed before the Rabin assassination back in the mid-90s. But he would come, and now he's the head of opposition. And I think, like you said, he doesn't have to be there. And, you know, maybe it's a little break with protocol, but he's able to make that decision. But again, it comes back to something of that I think is deeper, that ties into the Shin Bet, that maybe even ties into the Ayelet Shaked thing. Something should be above politics, like trashing, making fun of a politician because she has an accent, ignoring the presence of a prime minister at a security organization transition of power ceremony, which happened at the Shabak. And this whole thing that always happens every year, the robbing ceremony. The culture could be better here, and unfortunately it's not. And this is just, these are symptoms of a larger problem, I think, that we have.
Yeah. I mean, it's, the politics are very, very ugly here and very personal. Yeah. And I just, with the robbing thing, like, I just think for many years it has become a place where the left trashes the right. It's not just Netanyahu. They also trash, like, religious people, especially religious Zionists, because the assassin, Yigal Amir, was a religious Zionist. And it's just, you know, if they want there to be a lesson learned for this to be a national day of mourning where we all talk about unity, then show unity. You know, and there are efforts every year in Tel Aviv. The big youth groups in Israel hold like round tables, right, where kids, like teenagers from different walks of society, talk to each other about, you know, what happened, etc. And I think that that's a really great effort. But unfortunately, the ugliness is still there every year.
So, Lahav, just quickly, one other topic that we wanted to touch on yesterday, or earlier this week, sorry, at the cabinet meeting, Justice Minister Gideon Saar brought a proposal to amend existing law and to give the police the authority to enter people's homes without a court mandated warrant in search of ammunition, guns, weapons. This is being done to try to stem or combat this wave of murders that we've seen in the Arab, particularly in the Arab sector. This week, we marked the 100th murder in the Arab sector. On Monday, a man was murdered. So people on the one hand are saying, yes, this is a war and we need to take some dramatic steps. But there are other people who are saying this is an invasion of privacy. It's a breakdown of civil liberties. How do you see this playing out in the Knesset?
It'll be interesting in the Knesset. I think that the people who have the sort of strongest, or some of the people who sort of have the strongest background when it comes to civil liberties and, you know, trying to prevent government overreach, are now the ones trying to pass this law. I mean, Gideon Saar, for example, you know, tried to bring in norms in the legal system that you see in the United States, for example, that evidence that the police gets in a way that was not proper cannot be submitted to the court. You know, just as one example of the kinds of things Gideon Saar tried to pass. The Knesset's, I would say, closest thing to a libertarian, Sharren Haskel, is in Gideon Saar's party. And of course, this new warrant-free search policy is Gideon Saar's policy, is Justice Minister Saar's policy. There are some people still in Likud, and also I would say Councilmember Simcha Rotman from the Religious Zionist Party who care about these kinds of things. And so I think that they will really try to oppose it. But within the coalition, what's interesting is that it seems the Arab Knesset members want a real crackdown on crime, and they are not opposing this. Now, I add a little bit of an asterisk, which is that in the Ra'am party, it seems that they don't have like the strictest discipline. And so we might find out in the coming days that one or two of the Knesset members there oppose it. But so far, what we're hearing from Arab Knesset members, you know, Isawi Fred from Meretz, he said something in the cabinet meeting along the lines of, you know, if we had to call in the CIA, I would be okay with it. Like anything to just stem the rampant crime that has gone up like crazy in recent years in Arab areas. But I think that, you know, caution is important. And when you give the government more power, it's hard to take it away. To some extent, you see that in the pandemic, right? That it's like you can't even debate it. And I'm not like a conspiracy theorist. Like, I believe there's a pandemic and I think we should all get vaccinated. And you know, the early lockdowns were justified. But once you give your government emergency power, you know, it's when you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail, you know, and I do worry about the slippery slope.
I think you're right. And I think it's something that we have to be concerned about. And we actually in an editorial this week called for the government to ensure that there is constant legal advisors who are, I would say, accompanying the police on these operations and giving them the approval, even if they don't go to court, and also making sure that citizens whose homes the police raid without these warrants have a way to immediately complain and to try to fight something if they feel that it was done without legitimate grounds. And just lastly, Lahav, we have two interviews that we did this week with the podcast. One is with Danny Ayalon, the former Israeli ambassador to Washington. We spoke to him after the news on Monday that former Secretary of State and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Colin Powell, had passed away from complications of COVID-19. Danny Ayalon was the ambassador at the time when Colin Powell was the Secretary of State. So we recalled with him how the role that Powell played in Israeli foreign policy and his relationship with the State of Israel. And we also spoke with Professor Ephraim Inbar, the president of the Jerusalem Institute for Strategy and Security. I think I got that right. And we spoke to him about the visit of the Indian foreign minister. India, a massive country with over a billion people, massive, quick-growing, fastest-growing economy.
The world's biggest democracy.
Yeah, world's biggest democracy, visiting the tiny State of Israel for almost, I think, 4 or 5 days of a visit. So very interesting in itself. We spoke about the kind of the Indian-Israeli relationship, what that looks like, the role that India plays with Iran, Pakistan. So the two really interesting interviews. Let's go. It's great to be joined by Danny Ayalon. Danny is Israel's former ambassador to the United States from 2002 to 2006. Previously, he served as a foreign policy advisor to then Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. And he knew the former Secretary of State and former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Colin Powell, quite well from Colin Powell's visits to Israel, dealings between Israel and the United States. And I want to start with you, Danny, by kind of just an overview, how you perceived Colin Powell, who passed away this week from COVID complications at the age of 84. But also, if you could talk about, I mean, that was a tense period in time between Israel and the United States, right? Second Intifada, Bush is rolling out the roadmap, the Americans want to see freeze on settlement construction, and Colin Powell's in the middle of all of this. So how did that relationship work?
Yes, well, first of all, Yaakov, it's a pleasure to be here with you, and thanks for inviting me. Well, I knew Colin Powell very well. If I have to, call him in one word, I would say a friend, and in two words, an intimate friend. And that comes from, first of all, his demeanor, which is, you know, very, very nice. You know, you never felt uncomfortable with him, even if we had exchanges of and differences, and sometimes, with other U.S. officials. I will not name them now. Maybe at some point, you know, the voice can be raised, and even some yelling and being very tough. With him, it would never happen. Even if it was a tough conversation, he always did it in a soft-spoken voice with kind of a nice glitter in his eyes, and he told, you know, all his gestures and words were of a friend, somebody who cares for you, not just personally, but also for the State of Israel and the Jewish people. I think I told you before, Yaakov, he spoke a little Yiddish. His Yiddish right. was certainly better than mine, and we would laugh about it. But he really was someone that you could count as a friend. And at some point, he would even give me some advice. Some of it was unsolicited, and of course, it served also American interests. But, you know, he would tell me about some character or another, how to approach them, what not to do, and that was very, very helpful.
So, but this was a period when there was pressure, right, from the U.S. for Israel to behave in different ways that it didn't want to at the time, and that sort of is what led up to the disengagement. What was he like in those, I guess, more tense moments between the countries?
And if I could just add, Danny, you know, I was reading an old article from 2003 that was published on BBC. And it spoke about a visit that Colin Powell made to Israel at the time
and had a meeting with Ariel Sharon, who, of course, was then the prime minister. And Powell was trying to push Sharon on a settlement freeze. And this was the quote that Sharon, according to this BBC article, at least, said to Colin Powell about the settlements. Our finest youth live here, live there. They're already the third generation. They return home. They get married. So now they can't build a house and have children. What do you want for a pregnant woman to have an abortion just because she's a settler? So, I mean, just kind of to add to what Lahav said, right, which I don't know if that's what Sharon really said, but that does sound a bit the way that he used to talk, maybe very blunt.
Well, right. And Sharon would get up and say, Israel's not going to be Czechoslovakia. You know, things that are, you know, that could raise things that come from tensions. Let's put it that way.
Right. Well, Lahav and Yaakov, I very well remember. First of all, the BBC report was quite accurate. I was on this meeting. And also, I was in the office at the Tel Aviv, you know, HaKiria, when the fax at the time shot the papers in his very nice round handwriting of Sharon, you know, about this Czechoslovakia speech. We tried to dissuade him from doing that, but he insisted, and I think he was in hindsight he was right to do it. But with Powell, again, even if we had differences, and certainly we had differences about the settlements, we came up with a solution. At that point, after Sharon told him that, you know, of course you cannot limit natural growth and all that, so he tried to come up with some kind of reasonable or practical solution. For instance, he said, okay, so what about if we will kind of determine that you can build within the municipal boundaries of each of the communities, the settlements, but not outside? Maybe we can do it that you, that the Israeli government will publish and know that it's not going to give some special incentives to live in the territories, all kinds of practical things that never brought, which he knew very well, because James Baker was the foreign, was the Secretary of State when Powell was a chief of staff, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. So he knew Baker could be brutal. John Kerry, you know, the one under the Secretary of State under Obama, also could be very, very almost nasty, I would say. With Powell, you never felt that. And always he was looking for the common ground.
Do you think that that was a result of his long military career and the relationship? You know, he was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs during the first Gulf War. He had a strong relationship with the IDF. He knew the threats, I think, that Israel was facing and how it grappled with them. Do you think that's where that came from? Unlike the other two who you mentioned, Kerry, Baker, who didn't have that same kind of military-esque background?
Well, I think, Yaakov, that was a main influence on him and his behavior. I mean, from his start, from upbringing in a Jewish family that he really appreciated, they took him in. He always talked about the Jewish customs, traditions, family values. He really liked it. And also, by the way, in his own family life, he was a family man, you know, Alma, which also we knew very much, my wife and I, you know, they would come to our home, the ambassador's residence in Washington. Alma was also there was such a great relationship. You know, it was Alma that actually, it's because of her that he didn't run for president. You know, he had a great chance to become the first black president. You know, he was very, very popular with great esteem and the right record. And he didn't do it because she really didn't want to be in the limelight. I remember at one conversation, she said that she was afraid that he would be assassinated, you know, as the first black president. And also she felt that it wasn't for her to be the first lady. So yes, his upbringing, his affinity with the Jewish people, with Israel, and also during his very intense cooperation, defense cooperation between the IDF and the American military, all this brought him to really not only to realize the value of Israel as a great strategic asset for the United States, but also as a value, as a value, Western value beacon here in a very, very tough region. So for all these reasons, he felt very much committed to Israel's security and welfare.
So this year was the 20th anniversary of the Durban conference, and I had done some extensive reporting on it. And I read about how for Colin Powell, there was some sort of personal tension, I would say, over it, because it was a conference that was meant to be against racism, against people of African descent, like Colin Powell. And so this was an important issue to him. But when it started to become a festival of anti-Semitism and Israel bashing, you know, in the end, he and President George W. Bush made the call to leave. And I was just wondering if you had any involvement. I know that's when you were foreign affairs advisor to the prime minister. And if you had heard anything about that.
Exactly. That was also an intense communication between Jerusalem and Washington at the time. I was at the prime minister's office at the time as a foreign policy advisor to Ariel Sharon. And we realized quite from the start that this Durban, supposedly a lofty idea of equality and human rights and all these things in the world, that this was going to be hijacked by the Palestinians and their collaborators, which it did. And I think it hurt the cause of all those who are underprivileged, whether it's in Africa or Asia or anywhere else in the world. And this is exactly the conversation I had with Colin at the time, and he got it right away. He didn't need any convincing. There were some European governments that we had to really work hard for them to withdraw their participation. And they gave all kinds of argumentations. Powell understood it right away. And again, I say, if I go after that to Afghanistan, they gave us a heads up. Mm-hmm. At the time, George W. called Sharon on a red line, on a encrypted line. And it was Powell who told me that he was going to call Sharon. And that was like a few hours before the American bombers, took off to Afghanistan. So all around, as I said, we felt like a kinship. And, as he said, it's the mishpucha. And I'm quoting him. He said it, mishpucha. So he was really fun, and yeah, he'll be missed. I miss him personally.
Danny, I want to ask you, though, one, I don't know who am I to judge necessarily, but one stain on Powell's record was that decisive UN speech that he gave in, I guess it was 2003, ahead of the invasion of Iraq, where he kind of tried to lay out the evidence of an Iraqi weapons of mass destruction at the United Nations. Those weapons of mass destruction were never found. And that was that undermined, or that speech and that whole buildup towards the invasion of Iraq has been very much viewed in the years since as undermining U.S. credibility. I'm wondering if, like, in Jerusalem at the time when this all happened, you hear a lot of people nowadays who would say, Iraq was a mistake. Anyhow, Americans should have gone into Iran. Okay. It's easy to judge in hindsight, but how that was viewed. Right. Was there a period that people here were saying, Powell might have his gravitas is not what it used to be. He might be falling from his mm-hmm. influence because of this.
Well, Yaakov, unfortunately, this is the case. Yes, he certainly lost a lot of, on his reputation and gravitas. After that, he was almost, I would say, not only preoccupied all the time disappointment and I guess sorrow about what he would have loved to take the clock back and not to do that. But that shows again to him being so loyal, to the hierarchy. I guess that was the discipline of 35 years in the military and also in the administration. He always was very loyal to his bosses. And even though he would have some dissent with them, and he did, he had a lot of dissents, especially with, at that time, the Secretary of Defense, also deceased now, Rumsfeld, and Condi Rice, which was then the advisor, the National Security Advisor. would have dissent with them, but when the decision was made, he would grab it and take it as if it was his own. And yes, this UN speech at the you know, with the, bringing his vials, if you remember showing the vials in the Security Council, this is something that he always saw as a stain
right.
on his reputation. Here in Israel, of course, it didn't take away anything from what we thought about him. But in the world, especially in Europe and also in the United States, certainly those who were anti-Bush and anti-Republicans took it as a, I would say, as a platform to discomfort him and to try to ruin his reputation.
One last question, and then we're going to let you go. But, you know, you mentioned before the different secretaries of state that came before him and after him. You mentioned Baker specifically and Kerry. Israel is now again facing a Democratic administration. We know that there's maybe the tension is not yet public and above surface, but it's definitely going to be coming on the Jerusalem consulate and that the Biden administration wants to open. And they're probably going to make some requests about settlements at one point. If you had to, if you look back at Colin Powell and you have to give advice to the Israelis and the Americans now in saying, okay, there's going to be disagreements, but this is how you should manage that relationship. What would that advice be?
Well, first of all, I would say, you know, it's agreeing to disagree. You know, there are a few golden rules in the very special relationship between Israel and the United States. One is, of course, no surprises. The other one is, of course, always caring for one another's important or vital interests. And agreeing to disagree. And that is, with Powell, it worked very well, which didn't with Baker, for instance, or even Kerry. And what do I mean by agreeing to disagree? That was, we separate totally disagreement we had. And all the disagreements were on one issue, which is the Palestinian issue. It has nothing to do with Israel-U.S. bilateral relations. You know, Israel-U.S. bilateral relations, I mean, we are a natural allies of the United States. And those who are in the know over there understand it. And I think Baker, what he tried to do is actually use American leverage on the bilateral relations, for instance, the loan guarantees that we needed, and he prevented us. Because of not something that we did to the United States, but we didn't agree on a third-party issue like with the Palestinians. And I think this is the point we have to drive in Washington. We are natural allies. There are so many other big fish to fry together. You know, Iran, for instance, is the first one. Let's concentrate on what we agree and not what we do not agree. And there is an issue we do not agree. All of the issues we do not agree are on the Palestinian court. So let's separate those and try to deal with this. In any case, I think the landscape, the geostrategic and the political landscape in the Middle East now is very helpful to do the separation between the bilateral and the Palestinian issue, because the Palestinian is going way down on the priority list of the international community. A lot of it is because of their mistakes. And I've always said that, you know, it's always good to quote Abba Ibn, who said they never missed an opportunity, you know, to miss an opportunity. And they have missed a lot of trains. So this is why they are left right. alone in the station. It's their issues, not ours, and this is why the Americans should not take it on us.
All right, well, thank you so much, former Ambassador Ayalon, for joining us. A lot of interesting things to say, and we'll be happy to have you back another time.
Anytime, my pleasure. Thank you.
That was Danny Ayalon, Israel's former ambassador to the United States, talking about the country's relationship with Colin Powell. And now an interview with Ephraim Inbar, president of the Jerusalem Institute for Security and Strategy, about Israel's relationship with India upon the visit of India's foreign minister to Jerusalem this week.
Here with us is Professor Ephraim Inbar, president of the Jerusalem Institute for Strategy and Security, who has a special interest in Israel-India relations, has written a lot about it, and he's here to discuss with us the visit of Indian Foreign Minister, let's see if I get this right, Subramaniam Jaishankar, who is in Israel this week. So could you tell us a little bit about the significance of this visit?
Well, first of all, we have to realize that it is a high-level visit, and the Indians are continuing with high-level visits because they see Israel as an important country, and as Prime Minister Modi termed it, a strategic partner for India. And I don't know if you are aware, in the skies of Israel are flying Indian airplanes that are part of an international blue flag military exercise in which also the United States, Germany, Greece, and Israel, of course, are participating.
Ephraim, I'm curious, though, the relationship today between Israel and India, for the last, I would say, probably 20 years at least, it's very much revolved around the sale of advanced military platforms that Israel was developing and was selling to the Indians. Sometimes we were exporting to India around $1 billion a year. And there was a point back in the, I would say, mid-2000s, around 2010, when Israel even overtook Russia as the primary arms supplier to the Indians. Now, how much of that is still at the focus, or is the conversation different today? Is it more about economic, trade, innovation, water? Like, what are they actually talking about in substance?
Well, I think even in the early days, the conversation was not only about defense and military equipment purchases. It was about terrorism. We shouldn't forget that the Indians are facing Islamic terrorism from Pakistan. I think the discussion also revolved around relations with the United States that have dramatically improved for the Indians. We helped them to overcome difficulties in Washington when they had a nuclear deal. We shouldn't forget that the Indians have not signed the NPT, like Israel. And right. Our lobby, together with the emergent at that time, you know, the Indian lobby, helped them overcome difficulties in having nuclear supplies from the United States. Also, we should understand that we have a similar outlook on international relations. India has matured since the days of non-alignment, and it is adopted, particularly with the advent of the BJP, the party that is identified with primarily with the Hindu majority in India, has adopted gradually a more realpolitik language that Israelis feel more comfortable with. But the military equipment, it's still very important. We don't sell large platforms. We sell the gadgets.
Well, I mean, there's drones, there's missiles, there's surveillance systems. I mean, there's a lot of sales that amount to hundreds of millions of dollars annually.
Yeah, I think in my assessment, it's probably over a billion, continues to be over a billion. Mm-hmm. And this is a long-range relationship, which both sides benefit. Some of our technology has been transferred to India, part of their policy of made in India, and some of our systems are now being built and manufactured by Indian factories.
So, I mean, in India and Israel have had full bilateral relations for 30 years now. They're now marking the anniversary. But since Narendra Modi became prime minister, it seems that it's gotten a lot warmer. You started talking about his party, the BJP, taking a more realpolitik approach. Could you sort of explain What was the shift between, I guess, the previous governments and this one? What is the difference that made them want to be friendlier with Israel?
Well, the Congress Party has, the Nehruvian foreign policy has always been suspicious of the United States, has been non-aligned, has been close to Russia. By the way, the relationship with Russia is still very good. The BJP is, of course, much more afraid of Islamic radicalism. And they see the Jewish state as a natural ally in fighting this phenomenon. The BJP that has been in opposition for many years and started, its ascent in Indian politics in the 90s, sees Israel as a friend. Generally, Indians see Israel as an old civilization, like them. They see the Americans as a new kid on the block. So they have something in common with the Israelis. And the BJP, I remember from my many visits there, were always willing to host Israelis. They were very interested in how Israel looks like, how Israel is able to meet the security challenges from its Muslim neighbors in their eyes. So I think the religious dimension has been important for the BJP.
Ephraim, there's also been they've played an interesting game when it comes to Iran. Even the foreign minister who's currently visiting Israel, I'm not going to pronounce his name right, but I'll try, Jaishankar, attended the inauguration back in August of the new Iranian president, Raisi. We also know that there was that bombing outside of Israel's embassy in Delhi back in January, in the beginning of this year, which Israel pointed a finger at Iran for trying to carry out against Israeli diplomats. So I'm just curious, where do they stand on the Iranian issue? And why are they kind of playing this double-sided game with the Iranians?
I think there are mainly two reasons. First of all, Iran, Persia, has been close to India geographically and to some extent culturally. Iran is, for them, the entrance to Central Asia, which they consider their backyard. It's close. It's just 300 kilometers from India. Mm-hmm. Also, the Iran is a neighbor of Pakistan, which is an enemy of India. And, of course, they try to have relations with Iran, which is a country that has a bumpy relationship with the Pakistanis. You know, the Baluchi minority in both countries. And so many links to historic links to Iran, but I must mention that on the nuclear issue they have distanced themselves a little bit from Iran. They voted at the IAEA, at the International Agency for Atomic Energy, with Israel, with the Americans, and the Iranians are not happy about it, but they still have in Iran, a big embassy with military attaches. I knew one of them. And they are, in many ways, very real politics. They understand that Iran is an important country. And there is another important element. This is the energy element. India mm-hmm. doesn't have oil. They import oil from Iran, which is close. And the Americans, when they adopted a sanction regime on many countries and prevented them from importing oil from Iran, India was an exception. The Indians were able to secure an exemption from the Americans on this issue. So this is another element in playing this game. C'est la vie, that's international relations.
I guess sometimes it is.
So there's a foreign minister here in Israel with a big trade delegation, you know, and talking about sort of potential for trade, greater trade between the two countries. Where do you think that there could be better cooperation on the civilian front?
India is a huge market. You know, we used to laugh when we met Indians, telling them, you know, you and us are a quarter of the world. It's over a million people there. So it's a huge market. India is gradually, their citizens are acquiring more wealth. We have a larger middle class that is able to buy products from Israel as well. In this respect, it's important. But also our expertise in agriculture, our expertise in the medical field, our expertise in technologies connected telephone systems. All these are very important in a growing India. India, the GNP is growing. Not as a Chinese level, but, you know, 6-7% a year. So this is a market that is natural for us. We have to expand our markets. I think Israel made a strategic decision some years ago that I personally pushed for, to start looking east, of course to China, but also to India. And so India is a huge market for us. And I know of many enterprises trying to do business in India. This is not easy because the Indian bureaucracy is terrible. And also, unfortunately, they have, like Israel, a socialist heritage, which makes regulation pervading almost every element of life. So it's not easy to do business in India, but I think they are removing some of the government presence in many areas.
Ephraim, and just finally, I'm curious about your take on Pakistan. I saw the piece you wrote for, I think it was Haaretz, maybe just over 2 years ago, about welcoming ties with Pakistan. Do you think that that's something that's still potential for Israel on the table? Do you think that that's something that the Indians would accept, would want to see Israel normalize relations with the Pakistanis?
This op-ed created a lot of questions from my friends in India. And I specified in this op-ed that relations with Pakistan should not be at the expense of India. India is much more important to us. But Pakistan is, after all, the largest Muslim country, with the exception of Indonesia. And we definitely have an interest in having relations with Muslim nations. It will be a problematic relationship because part of Pakistan is becoming radicalized. And I'm not sure that, there will be a welcoming for Israelis in Pakistan. But if it's possible to have, in continuation of the Abraham Accords, relations with countries like Indonesia or Pakistan, we should not say no. And, of course, being quite honest that we have no intention of giving up the good relations we have with India, which are those relationships are very important to us.
Right. Well, Professor Ephraim Inbar from the Jerusalem Institute for Strategy and Security, thank you very much for joining the Jerusalem Post podcast.
My pleasure.
following our interview about former Secretary of State Colin Powell, it's important to me, at least, to note that a lot of the reporting on Powell's death has led sort of with the fact that he was vaccinated but died of COVID-19, and takes them a little more time, before, if at all, that they note that he, first of all, he was 84 years old, and second, he had cancer, which made him much more vulnerable in this pandemic. And so, you know, I think the media has a responsibility to report on these issues in a way that reflects the truth, which is that the vaccine is proven to be safe and highly effective, at least for 6 months, and then you can get a booster. And so I wanted to make sure that that is clear to everyone, that, you know, that it's safe, and that this story specifically should not be discouraging people from getting vaccinated. And that is the end of our podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. If you enjoyed it, please share with your friends and family. The podcast is available on all major podcast platforms, Apple, Spotify, etc. And we will be back next week.